Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 19th of November, these are our main stories. Reversing four decades of U.S. foreign policy, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has announced that Washington no longer considers Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank illegal. Some prominent figures in the Hong Kong administration have entered the blockaded campus of the Polytechnic University and persuaded a number of protesters to leave. Georgian police using water cannon have driven protesters from the camp they'd set up outside the parliament in the capital, Tbilisi. Also in this podcast, in a French auction, a rare miniature magazine written nearly 200 years ago by the British author Charlotte Bronte has sold for more than $660,000. The U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has announced that Washington no longer considers Israeli settlements built in the occupied West Bank to be illegal. The move breaks with four decades of State Department policy. Mr. Pompeo said that various U.S. administrations had vacillated on the issue for 40 years.
The establishment of Israeli civilian settlements in the West Bank is not, per se, inconsistent with international law. The Trump administration is reversing the Obama administration's approach towards Israeli settlements. U.S. public statements on settlement activities in the West Bank have been inconsistent over decades.
Mr. Pompeo denied the decision gives a green light to Israel to build more settlements and that the intention was to show support for the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's struggling to hold on to power following two inconclusive elections. In a video posted on Twitter, Mr. Netanyahu welcomed the decision.
This is a historic day and another great achievement of our policy. After President Trump recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, recognized our sovereignty in the Golan Heights, now the U.S. administration has put an end to the lie that settlements are illegal. I thank President Trump and I thank Secretary of State Pompeo.
But the Palestinian chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, condemned the shift in U.S. policy.
Once the Trump administration decide to undermine international law, once they become an administration that's pro-Israel's occupation, pro-Israel war crimes, this is constitute a major threat to international peace and security. And this is turning the international community from the rules of international law, the rules of solving conflicts by peaceful means, into the rules of the jungle.
James Kumarasamy spoke to the BBC's Alim Makbul and asked him how significant this decision by the US is.
Well, it is significant, but certainly in keeping with what we've seen from the Trump administration over the last couple of years in recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And also earlier this year, you'll remember recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, an area occupied in the Six-Day War of 1967 from Syria. But you're right to talk about 4 years of State Department legal advice, which came under the Carter administration at that time, the State Department decided that Israel building Jewish settlements on land that was captured in that Six-Day War from Palestinians and occupied was inconsistent with international law. And what Mike Pompeo has done, the Secretary of State, is to officially overturn that. And he said it's because calling them inconsistent with international law had not advanced peace, and by somehow recognizing the reality on the ground would help advance a peace process. That is certainly not what Palestinians will feel about this. And perhaps a lot of European countries too, of course, who all still consider Jewish settlements in the West Bank
as
illegal.
The EU already putting out a statement to that effect. But what about the timing of this, Aline? What do you make of that?
Yeah, that is interesting because, you know, Palestinians will already feel that the United States has not been an honest peace broker and has turned a blind eye to this massive expansion of settlements in recent years. I mean, we talk about them as settlements, which sounds like a small thing, but really they dominate the landscape in the West Bank now. Some of them are no less than cities. There's one called Male Adumim, which pretty much cuts the West Bank in half. So Palestinians already felt that the United States didn't really tackle the issue of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. So why make this announcement now? And there are many commentators who look at this and think that the only real reason for the timing of this is to somehow boost Benjamin Netanyahu at a time when he is locked in sort of political impasse in Israel. And certainly it is being seen as something that could boost his standing. But in recent announcements, like, for example, the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital, it did lead to consequences. It led to protests. It led to deaths. And there are fears that the same could happen this time.
Ali Makbul. Prominent figures in Hong Kong have entered the blockaded Polytechnic University campus and persuaded a number of protesters to leave. A journalist for the Reuters news agency told the BBC that several dozen mostly younger activists left and the police agreed to give them safe passage. Some protesters escaped earlier using fire hoses to descend from a bridge to waiting motorbikes below. Those still inside the campus are described as exhausted but tenacious and insist they will not surrender. The university is surrounded by police. Our correspondent Robin Brandt spent Monday outside the university and he sent this report.
Throughout the day, a game of cat and mouse played out. Protesters trying to flee the university campus, the police trying to make arrests. At one point, a group of protesters was seen abseiling down ropes from a footbridge before fleeing on the back of waiting motorcycles. Earlier in the day, we saw a larger group appear in the deserted highway below where we stood and clamber over barriers.
So it's 1:45 and all of a sudden we hear tear gas and you look down and see a large crowd of protesters. They're basically making a run for it. They came running out over the barriers, a large amount of tear gas fired down in their direction.
Then another mass demonstration began, this time a protest in support of the protesters. Tens of thousands of people arrived close to the university. They blocked roads with bricks, plastic barriers, and even portable toilets. They had come, they said, because they wanted to save their friends inside. We spoke to Jason, one of the protesters inside the building, on the phone. He told us that food and water supplies were dwindling, but they still have petrol bombs. The chief executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, condemned the rioters for the violence and called on them to obey the police, but that call went unheeded. The way out of this situation is still very unclear. Hong Kong is heading for local elections this weekend. District councils will be decided, a barometer of public opinion, but it's one the government is still unsure about whether it can go ahead.
Robin Brandt in Hong Kong. Deforestation of the Amazon rainforest in Brazil has gone up by nearly 30% in 12 months. That is the highest level of deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon in a decade. Nearly 10,000 square kilometers of forest were destroyed between August 2018 and July 2019, according to Brazil's Space Research Agency. Environmentalists accuse President Jair Bolsonaro of encouraging logging, mining, and cattle ranching in the Amazon since taking office in January. Krupa Paddy spoke to the BBC's Camila Mota, who's in São Paulo, and asked her for more on the findings.
The numbers that show a surge in deforestation goes from August 2018, so before Bolsonaro took office, to July, so the past 12 months. And so you guys have an idea, the area of the rainforest lost during this time is as big as the Cyprus island in the Mediterranean, so we're talking about huge amount of forest.
Incredible. In terms of the report itself, I've got two questions for you. First of all, why is it the Space Research Agency carrying out this report, rather? And isn't this the same organisation whose data was challenged by Jair Bolsonaro when the Amazon fires first happened?
Yes, the space agency is in charge of monitoring the satellite data that's brought every day about the Amazon rainforests, so they are historically in charge of putting out those numbers for more than a decade now. And yes, this is the same agency that was discredited by Bolsonaro a few months ago. Actually, its director was sacked by Bolsonaro at the time, but the technical staff is still the same. So Bolsonaro and his Ministry of Environment haven't commented on the numbers so far, but they could very likely discredit them again.
And they've not commented, but the report clearly states that the president favors development over conservation.
As you said before, Mr. Bolsonaro is very aligned with loggers, miners and farmers. They made a very, very important base for him during the election. So what people say is that those groups have been favored over conservationists.
In terms of the situation on the ground there in the Amazon, we reported on it extensively at the time when those fires were burning. What is the situation there like now on the ground?
The fires are now under control because the climate is a bit more humid. So usually, historically in Brazil, the fires are at their worst during June and July. So they're better now. But I've been talking to Ministry of Environment employees, and what they've been saying to me is that it's really hard for them to keep doing their job because the Ministry of Environment is becoming very disarticulated, disorganized. They have to ask for permission to take small decisions, so it's really hard for them to tackle crises like the Amazon fires or the oil spills in the Brazilian coast we've seen the past months.
Camila Mota, who is in São Paulo, Brazil's environment minister, says he'll hold an emergency meeting with governors from Amazon states on Wednesday. Now to Georgia and the capital, Tbilisi. Riot police on Monday used water cannon to disperse protesters outside the parliament in the city. The police intervention came after thousands of demonstrators called on the government to resign on Sunday. They're demanding electoral reform, a much-anticipated bill for proportional representation promised by the ruling Georgian Dream Party failed to pass. I heard more from the BBC's Rehan Dimitri in Tbilisi.
Earlier, riot police used water cannon to push protesters away from all the entrances to the parliament building. And they've managed to clear the main street, which has been blocked since last Thursday, when parliament, which is dominated by Georgian Dream Party, failed to pass this much awaited and very important bill on electoral reform.
And why are these protesters so passionate about wanting electoral reform?
Well, because the Georgian opposition, civil society here, also Georgia's international partners, they believe that this change would have ensured that there's more kind of democratic representation in Georgian parliament. Because at the moment, it is dominated by Georgian Dream Party, and it has been for the past 8 years. So that was one reason. The second reason is because the government, and most importantly, the chairman of the ruling party, he is the richest man in Georgia, billionaire Bidzina Ivanishvili, made this promise back in the summer during really big anti-government protests. This was the concession that the government made, and the chairman of the ruling party personally made that promise. So failure to introduce this bill is seen by the opposition and those protesters as it's a big disappointment for them.
Rehan Dimitri in Tbilisi. Russia has returned three Ukrainian Navy vessels almost a year after they were seized in the Black Sea off the Crimean Peninsula. The move comes 3 days after it was confirmed that the presidents of Ukraine and Russia would meet for the first time at a summit in France next month. From Kiev, here's our correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
The handing over of the ships is another indication that the previously icy relationship between Russia and Ukraine is continuing to thaw. A year ago, a major escalation seemed more likely, as the three small Ukrainian naval vessels were fired on and then captured as they approached the Kerch Strait off the coast of Russian-occupied Crimea. But the election of a new president in Ukraine has fundamentally changed the dynamic. Volodymyr Zelensky has made ending the conflict with Russian-backed rebels in eastern Ukraine his number one priority. In the last few months, the former comedian has made concessions his predecessor was unwilling to make, including withdrawing from some parts of the front line. President Zelensky's critics have accused him of naivety and capitulating to Russia. But for now, he appears to be making some progress. In 3 weeks' time, he will hold his first face-to-face meeting with Russia's President Vladimir Putin in Paris.
Jonah Fisher. Also in the podcast...
One woman told Le Parisien newspaper that when she refused alcohol because she was ill, her boss exclaimed, "You're not working for Perrier."
Some employees of the French company Pernod Ricard claim a perk of free alcohol is making them ill. The company denies this. To the United States now, and President Trump's policies and rhetoric on immigration have resulted in many Hispanic families living in fear. Pressure on law enforcement agencies to curb the rising number of illegal immigrants has encouraged the use of divisive methods. In one case, two American women were questioned just for speaking Spanish. Ana Suda is one of those women, and she sat down with the BBC's Angelica Casas to tell her story.
We just come here to the store to buy milk and eggs, and this border patrol, he just asked for ID because we have an accent and we speak Spanish.
This cell phone video recorded by Ana Suda and Marta Hernandez went viral in 2018.
Ma'am, the reason I asked you for your ID is because I came in here and I saw that you guys are speaking Spanish, which is very unheard of up here.
The two friends were waiting in line at a shop in Montana when a Border Patrol agent stopped and questioned them.
So it is illegal to speak Spanish in Montana?
No, ma'am, it's not illegal. It's just very unheard of.
Really?
The two women are U.S.-born citizens, and they filed a lawsuit claiming the agent violated their constitutional rights when he demanded to see their identification.
I wasn't doing anything wrong. I was just speaking Spanish, you know? That's not illegal.
Ana never could have imagined the consequences that viral moment would have on her life.
It's been very difficult. He destroyed all my dreams I have to live like my husband wants in Montana forever.
Ana's husband, Sean, is a fifth-generation Montanan.
I never would have imagined something like this would happen, not even in... It certainly wouldn't happen anywhere on the southern border like this, but I never imagined it would happen in Montana either.
He works for Customs and Border Protection, the same agency that stopped Ana.
It's been difficult for all of us. You know, I work for the same agency as Border Patrol, and there's been some discomfort within the job. My wife, she's been harassed within the community. It's been, and my children too. It's been difficult for all of us, the whole family.
Ana was born in Texas, but moved to Montana with her husband in 2014.
I was born in the United States of America.
Following the viral video, Ana and her younger daughter were repeatedly harassed.
People start, you know, attacking us. It's pretty tough. It's because it's in a small town. I don't feel safe anymore in that town.
So Ana and Sean decided it was best to move the family back to Texas.
They're attacking my kids now. I can't be here anymore. It's for the safety of my kids, my family.
Ana's fear is now common among Spanish-speaking communities across the United States. A 2018 Pew Research study found that 4 out of 10 Latinos in the U.S. had experienced discrimination in the last year, such as criticism over speaking Spanish.
Yes, we stopped speaking for a little bit, but after a while, no. We need to be strong and we need to do stuff. We need to let people know that they can speak Spanish.
The same study also found that under the current administration, half of Latinos in the U.S. say their situation has worsened. Here's President Trump speaking at a Republican presidential debate in 2015.
We have a country where to assimilate, you have to speak English. I'm not the first one to say this. We've had many people over the years, for many, many years, saying the same thing. This is a country where we speak English, not Spanish.
There are more than 41 million Spanish speakers in the U.S., and Ana doesn't want them to feel afraid.
This needs to stop. We are good people. We are not doing anything wrong. We are not less. We just speak another language.
Ana Suda ending that report by Angelica Casas. The Czech capital Prague has approved a memorandum with the Jewish community on returning fragments of Jewish gravestones that were used to cobble streets in the communist period. Under the agreement, any stones recovered during future roadworks will also be returned and placed in a cemetery in Prague. Rob Cameron sent this report from the city.
So I took two stones. You can
Earlier this year, the BBC was shown several cobblestones that had been taken in the 1980s from a pile waiting to be laid at the bottom of Wenceslas Square.
At least this part, so I'm sure.
The man who'd stumbled across them on his way to work 3 decades ago is Leo Pavlat.
I used to work not far from here, so on the way to my to children publishing house, also I saw workers who made new pavement. There were piles of stones here, and all of a sudden I saw Hebrew inscriptions.
Mr. Pavlat is now the head of the Jewish Museum, and he believes they were cut from granite headstones taken from an abandoned Jewish cemetery in North Bohemia. The pair of stones he'd pocketed were clearly identical to the strip of cobbles at our feet. And it's not just Wenceslas Square. There are believed to be several more such areas in Prague. The city and the Jewish community will now map the most likely locations, but under the agreement they'll only remove the stones if it coincides with planned excavation work in the future.
Rob Cameron in Prague. The president of one of Britain's most prestigious debating societies, the Oxford Union, is facing calls to resign after a partially sighted student from Ghana was forcibly removed from one of its events. Ebenezer Azamati, who's 25, says security staff confronted him and dragged him from his seat. The union has been accused of racism. Duncan Kennedy has this report.
They've been holding debates at the Oxford Union since 1823, but few could have witnessed incidents like the one that took place last month. Ebenezer Azamati, who's a postgraduate student from Ghana and who's blind, had intended going to a debate at the Union and reserved a seat because he was concerned about accessibility. But when he returned to take up his seat, the lecture had already started and he was confronted by a security guard, apparently because the hall was full. When Mr. Azamati was offered a different chair by another member of the Union, it was then that staff, for some unknown reason, tried to remove him. The incident, recorded on a mobile phone, appears to show Mr. Azamati being manhandled by the guards. His colleagues from the university's African Society say he was dragged out by his feet. The Oxford Union, which is independent from the university, then accused Mr. Azamati of violent disorder. But today the union withdrew that allegation and apologised unreservedly to him. Mr. Azamati says he was traumatised by the incident and said it made him feel unwelcome at the debating society and in Britain. His lawyers say they're still having discussions with the Oxford Union over how they can make amends for what happened.
Duncan Kennedy. Now, an unusual story regarding patient confidentiality and serious genetic conditions. In Britain, a woman has told the High Court in London that she faces a horrifying future with Huntington's disease. The woman, who cannot be named, is suing 3 National Health Service trusts for not telling her that her father had the condition. She only learned about the illness after the birth of her daughter, who may now also have the disease. Our medical correspondent, Fergus Walsh, reports.
In emotional testimony, the woman, who's in her 40s, told the High Court she was now the prime age to get unwell, and the future was absolutely terrifying. Huntington's disease is a progressive, incurable brain disorder which leaves patients in permanent physical and mental decline. She told the High Court how she was left completely traumatised after being told about her father's condition by accident. She said she had no support and ended up having to Google the symptoms. She was left so scared she considered jumping off her roof terrace. The woman's father was diagnosed with Huntington's after he shot dead her mother, and doctors suspected he had the genetic disorder, which can cause aggressive behaviour. She was pregnant at the time of his diagnosis and said had she known then that she also carried the gene for Huntington's, she would definitely have had an abortion. Her daughter, who hasn't been tested, has a 50-50 chance of inheriting the faulty gene. The woman is suing St George's and 2 other NHS trusts for nearly £350,000. This could be a landmark case for where the balance lies between patient confidentiality and the potential duty of care owed to family members following testing for serious genetic conditions.
Fergus Walsh. There are fewer drinks more French than the anise-flavoured liqueur Pastis. You might think drinking it for free would be a perk of working for its producer, Pernod Ricard. But some staff say the drinking culture is so bad, it's made them ill. Pernod Ricard denies the allegations. Charlotte Gallagher has this report.
A former employee is taking Pernod Ricard to court, claiming his health has been damaged by heavy drinking encouraged by the company. The case is currently going through the French labour courts, with a verdict expected at the end of this month. But now several others have come forward to raise concerns about the company's drinking culture, detailing how they experienced hallucinations, heard voices, and became alcoholics. One woman told Le Parisien newspaper that when she refused alcohol because she was ill, her boss exclaimed, "You're not working for Perrier." Another, who was nicknamed Monsieur Ricard, described drinking 12 glasses of pastis a day and frequently driving drunk. In a statement, Pernod Ricard strongly denied it encouraged staff to consume alcohol. It's not the most unusual employment dispute the French legal system has dealt with this year. In September, a court ruled a company was liable for the death of an employee who had a heart attack while having sex with a stranger on a business trip.
Wow. Charlotte Gallagher. A tiny piece of literary history, no bigger than a box of matches, has sold at auction in Paris for $660,000. Written by a teenaged Charlotte Bronte in 1830, the miniature magazine will now go to the Parsonage Museum in the Bronte's old home in West Yorkshire in northern England. She's most famous for writing the novel Jane Eyre. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
À 600 000 euros, j'adjuge. Adjugez à vous, monsieur, bravo.
And with that, the miniature Bronte manuscript is set to come home to the Parsonage, now museum, where it was written nearly 200 years ago by a 14-year-old Charlotte. With her younger sisters Anne and Emily and brother Branwell, Charlotte created an intricate private universe peopled by characters of their imagination. It all started from a gift of toy soldiers. Each of the siblings took one and made it their hero. Some of their stories Charlotte wrote down in a childhood version of the kind of gentleman's magazine their father subscribed to. And being for children, it was absolutely minuscule. Antiquarian bookseller Edward Maggs conducted the bidding on behalf of the Bronte Museum.
It's exceptionally small. It's really, it qualifies as a miniature book in every respect. And the physical dimensions of it echo the privacy of the childish world. It's almost impossible for most adults to read it without big magnifying glasses. And so the privacy, the creation, the special world of childhood, it's a very beautiful object.
Four issues of the children's tiny magazine are already on display at the Bronte Museum, and now this fifth one joins the collection, to the delight of fans of the Brontes everywhere. It's a joyous glimpse at a childhood world of the mind, containing the seeds of the great books that were to come.
Hugh Schofield in France. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio Sampedro. Until next time, goodbye.
Emilio?
Yes?
Did you tell them about the Happy News Pod?
No, I haven't.
Do you mind if I do?
Well, go ahead.
Yes. Okay, the Happy News Pod is coming soon. We're having a roundup of all the best bits of 2019, all the inspiring, uplifting and joyful stories. And we have been inviting our listeners to send in happy stories of their own. We've had some brilliant ones so far, professional ones and personal ones, and some that made me cry, but in a good way. So if you have any happy moments that you would like to share as well, just record yourself on your phone, doesn't need to be anything fancy, who you are, where you are, what the happy thing was that made 2019 joyful for you, then attach it to an email and send it to the usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk.
That's great. Thank you.
See, it wasn't
hard. We need some happiness.
We need happiness. You could have done that for me, Amelia. Why didn't you?
I don't know.
Oh, it's a shame.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Banking with Capital One means 5 times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or 5 times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. even 5 times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, NA member FDIC.